As I was saying, we continued our local shakedown in San Francisco Bay, which was only a part of it. We had to complete our offshore shakedown by running on down to San Diego. And we learned a lot more about the ship on this short cruise. When we got back to San Francisco, we were ready for sea. We didn't have any idea where we were going. There was a lot of scuttlebutt about where we would be going. We knew we'd be going into the Pacific someplace. But finally our orders came through, and surprise, we were going up to the Aleutian Islands. Well, none of us knew too much about it. The skipper had been up there, Popenay had been up there at one time. He wasn't too happy about the idea of going back up there. Anyway, the time came, and Emily and I said our goodbyes with high hopes that we would see each other again sometime. Being wartime and heading out to sea, you really never knew whether you would be coming back or when you would be coming back. But we always had high hopes. Anyway, we headed on out, went under the Golden Gate Bridge, ran out to what we call the Farallones. These are a group of islands uninhabited offshore off San Francisco. And we made a turn north and headed for the Aleutians. Well, that was a rough and rocky trip. It was rough weather all the way from the time we got out to the Farallones until we got up to the underside of the Aleutian chain. As we approached the Aleutians, we would go through Unimak Pass between two of the islands and come out on the north side of the chain and then head for Dutch Harbor, which was to the west about another 60 or 70 miles. As we approached Unimak Pass, the weather socked in and we had practically zero visibility. Well, the question was, should we lay to or steam around waiting for it to clear up? Well, you never knew how long it was going to be socked in. We might be out there for days. So part of this responsibility lay with me, because I, in addition to being the executive officer, second in command, I was also the navigator. Fortunately, we had a chief petty officer, an old timer, old regular Navy man, who was a crackerjack, and he was so good. He taught me a lot about navigation on that trip up. In fact, he did quite a bit of it, because part of the time it was so rough I was seasick and I just had a hard time keeping my head up, let alone navigating. At any rate, as we were about to approach Unimak Pass and it was socked in, we, the skipper, made the decision that we would try to go through using our new radar. We had SL radar, which was a fairly new surface radar set, not fully proven yet, but this was going to be a good chance to test it out. Well, we plotted the opening. Up to that point, we had come by celestial navigation and were pretty sure of our position. So we picked out what appeared to be the opening of Unimak Pass, and we started steaming through, hoping that we weren't going to pile up on rocks someplace. Well, we got all the way through, and almost like the sky opened up after we were on the north side into the Bering Sea, and sure enough, we had passed through the chain with no mishap. We did hear, going through, we heard the sounds of the buoys, bell buoys, and that gave us another clear indication that we were on course. Well, we steamed on over and came into Dutch Harbor. Dutch Harbor was the main base at that time. Had been there for a few years and had been under attack by the Japanese earlier, and had survived the attack. So they had set up an air base, and that was in operation at this time. They had fairly good facilities ashore. They had an officers' club, which was attractive to us. It meant that on occasion when we would be putting into Dutch Harbor, we'd have a chance to go ashore and have a little refreshment. And it turned out that they had, in addition to that, they had a gymnasium where you could go in and play basketball or use the weights. And they also had a steam room, and you could get massages and a steam bath in there. And we availed ourselves of that in the months to come whenever we were in Dutch Harbor. Well, they put us right to work. The war in the Aleutians had reached its peak out at Attu. Some very tough landings had been made there just a couple of weeks before, and they were still in the process of mopping up, cleaning up the Japanese. The Japanese, of course, we had learned long before, were do or die. They were not going to be captured. If they didn't win, you had to knock them off. There were a few that were an exception to the rule. They did capture maybe a dozen or more, but out of several thousand, that's all that survived of the Japanese. Well, our first duty was to run out with a convoy out to Attu. And this was kind of exciting because it was going to be our first taste of battle conditions. We didn't know just exactly what we would come into. It turned out that we did not have any shooting activity on this first run. And we, from that point on, we would settle down to more or less of a routine of escorting, and a submarine work was going to be our primary function, not minesweeping, because they hadn't found any mines up to that point up in the Aleutians. About our second run out there, we escorted a merchant ship, and he was loaded with war material. Well, I had had a conference with him before we set out, and he let me know right away that he was an old Alaskan sailor and he really didn't need an escort. I said, well, maybe so, and you're probably a lot more familiar with the waters than I am, but that's our duty. We're to guide you out there, mostly to protect you from submarines if there are any on our way out there. Well, we made the trip out uneventfully, and as we were to approach the harbor, Nasker Bay at Attu, we got socked in again. This was just a common thing. Well, he wanted to go right on in. He says, I know my way in there. I've been in there before. And we said, well, it doesn't look too good. I think we ought to lay to out here. Well, the channel was just very rudimentarily marked. It just had dan buoys. They hadn't got around to put formal markers in yet because the fighting activity was still going on in a limited fashion ashore, and they hadn't got to those niceties of putting navigation aids in. Well, we instructed him to lay to until the weather cleared up, and then we would take him on in this elementarily marked channel. Well, it socked in, but good, to the point where we couldn't even see him. Oh, well, we were sitting there just waiting marking time when I kept my eyes glued to the radar, partly to ascertain that we weren't moving. We were just, our engines were not moving, our screws were not moving. But upon checking further our charge, this merchant ship, it appeared that he was moving. Well, sure enough, looked like he was moving right towards the channel. And in odd moments, we would get a little clearing and we could see that he was in fact moving and moving over there. Well, the skipper called him and said, "Do not undertake to go in there. You are to stay put. Those are your orders." Well, he paid no attention. He didn't answer. He had voice radio, so he could be in touch with us. And the next thing we knew, he had hung up on a pinnacle, a rock, a pointed rock that was just a few feet, the pinnacle of which was just a few feet below the surface, and he didn't see it. Well, he was in big trouble then. Well, what to do? He had violated his instructions from us, so we were in the clear, but at the same time, we had the problem of standing by him in case she began to sink. Well, she did. Presently, we could see her begin to sink lower in the water. The next thing we knew, we saw steam coming out from under. The pinnacle had pierced the engine room, apparently, and the steam boilers were emitting steam out the hole of the ship, or from underwater. Well, the ship didn't go all the way down, but because the water was so shallow at that point, but he was in dire trouble. Well, we had to call for outside help, and eventually tugs came and got him out of there. But he was in pretty desperate shape there, and not our fault. We felt badly about it, but he had violated our orders. Our routine was, as I had said, steaming mostly between either Adak and Attu, or from Dutch Harbor to Adak. We became quite familiar with Adak, which was about halfway out the chain to Attu from Dutch Harbor. And they were in the process of building up Adak as a major base. We put in at Tanaga, which was another island beyond Kiska, one time. And they had built a temporary air base there. Now, dealing with excavation, like putting in airfields, was a tough job in the Aleutians because the whole of the islands were covered with tundra, which was a very heavy and spongy grass-like substance. We found it was not practical to scrape out with bulldozers, and they had to move faster than they could tear all this tundra out. So they had a means of putting down temporary air bases with heavy perforated metal strips, which were joined together, and they would lay these down like a matting, covering an area as large as they needed to land and take off aircraft. We had one of our charges was to take a couple of ships to Tanaga, so while we were there, the skipper says, "Hey, let's go ashore and see what's going on." Well, he was a little brash, as I had found out a lot earlier than that. But anyway, we decided to go ashore in our whaleboat, went ashore and walked around the island a bit, and jumped up and down in this spongy tundra and visited this air base, which was just being put in at that time. But we had anchored offshore. Well, this turned out to be a poor decision on the skipper's part because he had no idea of what the bottom was, whether it was good holding bottom whether it was sand, rock, or what. All he knew is that the anchor caught and held. I should interject at this point that because of this anchor holding fast, when we went to up anchor, the anchor chain parted and we lost our anchor. Now, this turned out to have some very serious repercussions later on, which I'll get into in a little bit. Our duty in the Aleutians was rather boring for the reasons that I had mentioned before. We were on pretty much routine escort duty. There was one point, and I think it was in June, when we had a break from this routine. Kiska Island had been occupied by the Japanese, and our military, our naval force commanders knew that they were going to have to go in sooner or later and take Kiska over. So an operation order was developed, and we were a part of that operation order. Our job was to go in and sweep the night before the landing. We were, in fact, formed up and sweeping independently on the west side of Kiska, but we found no mines. However, during the night, one of the destroyers caught a mine and blew off the stern. There was a loss of life of about 15 men. A number of others were injured. That was the only indication of a mine that we had in the area. Now, we're going to jump ahead now briefly and tell you about an incident that occurred when we were returning to port at Adak. This would be up into early November. We came in to anchor and were given an assignment of an anchorage outside the submarine net. I called into operations and asked if there was any indication of any bad weather anticipated, and they came back with a report that we might expect winds up to 35 miles an hour, which really was nothing to be concerned about up there. Afternoon wore on and early evening came on. The wind came up, got more brisk and more brisk, and other vessels came in after us, two destroyer escorts, and they anchored very close to us on each side, and that made me very uncomfortable. By this time, I might say, I had taken command of the ship, hoping they couldn't get out of the Aleutians fast enough, and he certified me as qualified for command, and I was a little dubious about that. Because I felt I wanted command sometime of one of these ships, but I felt I wasn't quite ready yet. I needed more seasoning and more experience. But anyway, Popenay figured this was the way to get out of the Aleutians, and he certified me as command, and the Navy Department Personnel Division, Bureau of Personnel, okayed it, and I took command in early August. So at this point, I had had command of the ship for about 2.5 months, and everything was more or less uneventful up to this point. So anyway, we were anchored there, and I began to have a very uneasy feeling about this wind picking up. And as it got dark and became even more windy, we began to swing around our anchor. We had lost one anchor, by the way, on that trip that we had made into Tanaga, because when we were ready to leave, and the skipper, Popenay, had given the word up anchor, the chain came up, but the anchor stayed down because the anchor had caught in this very rocky bottom. It was turned out to be rocky bottom, which is poor anchoring area, and we only had one anchor. So here we were at Adak with this wind increasing. We had only one anchor, and as the wind got stronger, we were swinging around it more violently, and the two vessels anchored either side of us, one either side, they were swinging, And our action at anchor, all three ships became so erratic that at times we were swinging over and almost touching the other ships. We all had our fenders out because we were afraid we were going to bash into each other. Well, night came on, the wind came up, well, we knew we were in for problems. So I ordered the engines to be fired up, and we started steaming, what we call steaming, to the anchor at very slow speed, but that was to take some strain off the anchor. Even so, the wind catching our bow, and we had the configuration of these AMs, 220-foot AMs, had a fairly high bow, which meant that the wind would catch in it when you had high winds, and it would put even an extra strain on the anchor. Well, it began to rain and sleet, and I was spending all my time up on the bridge now. Dare not go below. So all of a sudden, a little past midnight, we felt a terrific wind blast. And suddenly we looked out, and here's our bow beginning to swing, and we knew something drastic had happened. Well, it turned out that our anchor chain had parted. What to do? We were in immediate danger of ramming the other ships, and there were ships behind us as well. We could have rammed several ships, damaged them, possibly broken their anchor chains, and we'd have had a fiasco. I decided to try to steam out of the situation and try to get out and get under control if I could get enough way on. But we steamed ahead, and dead ahead of us was ADAC, the land. So I figured, well, the best thing we can do is to ram the bow right into the shore, hoping that it's a sandy bottom and we won't damage the ship too badly. But we did go aground then, but in the process, our starboard propeller hit a submerged rock as we came in close to shore, and it also sheared the starboard shaft. Well, at least we were solidly fixed to the land so that we wouldn't go sailing all over the anchorage and hit other ships and damage ourselves to the boot. So the next best thing seemed to be to get our mooring lines ashore so that the wind wouldn't blow us off to the shore. And we managed to get those ashore, and by that time there were men ashore who realized that there was desperate things happening. It seemed that we were not the only ship that was in trouble. And they took our lines and lashed them to trees on shore. Well, about daybreak, the winds died down, and we finally realized what had happened. We saw the situation better then. We realized what had happened. We had been the victim of what is known as an Aleutian low. An Aleutian low is a low pressure area. It's an anticyclonic, just as a hurricane and a typhoon is. And they are common mostly to up in the Aleutians. They have an eye, which, just like a hurricane, when the eye passes over, the whole system is moving. And when the eye passes over, you get a period of calm. Well, during that period of calm, the period was much longer, and the eye was much larger than a hurricane. That meant we had some time to do something. But we called for an emergency help to shore, and called for a tug to get us off the shore where we had run aground. Well, they managed to get one out there and pulled us off and towed us inside the anchorage at ADAC. and took us alongside a destroyer tender. Well, for the moment, we were safe. By then, we had a chance to assess our damage, and we did have a hole in the bottom. Not a big one, but we were taking on water in the after lazarette, which is the storage area near the stern. We were not in danger of sinking, but we had damage, and it was going to require repairs. Well, the after side of the Aleutian Low finally came over, and it moved very fast, so we had high winds. Well, by then, as I said, we were tied alongside this destroyer tender. The backside of Low passed over, and within 6 or 8 hours, the winds began to recede, and we began to breathe a little easier. I might add briefly here that we found out later that the high winds, the gusts that parted our anchor chain, registered at 96 miles an hour, so that gives you a pretty good idea of the velocity and the force of the wind. Since we couldn't be repaired alongside the destroyer tender, we were given orders to proceed to Dutch Harbor, since we had one good screw. So we did that. We proceeded over there, and we went into a portable dry dock at Dutch Harbor to assess the... This portable dry dock was an interesting development by the Navy Department. We had seen one, we had passed one somewhere along our travels, and we were trying to figure out what the thing was. It stood up, way up in the air, looked like nothing we had ever seen before. But these portable dry docks made a great difference during the war in the Pacific, when ships could not get back to the mainland where many large dry docks were, and they could affect emergency repairs many times in these portable dry docks out in the far Pacific. Now, this little respite at Dutch Harbor gave us time to reflect on just the seriousness of what had happened. We really were very saddened by what had happened, and yet, when you stop to think of it, it could have been a whole lot worse. It could have been a situation where we would have been lost, we could have foundered and sunk, or we could have damaged other ships around us, and it could have been a real mayhem situation.
The Navy Department
decided to call a court of inquiry right there at Dutch Harbor to look into this matter, to get the facts and figures about it. And this I was not looking forward to very much. Officer, it was like, you know, in a sense, it was like a court-martial, but I wasn't on trial in that sense. But I had to give testimony and so forth, I was wondering what the result of that was going to be, whether I was going to be relieved of the command of the ship or just what. Well, eventually, I got a letter from the commander of the 7th Fleet, which was the service fleet under which we operated, their offices being in Pearl Harbor. And it was what is called a letter of admonition, which in effect says, don't do it again. Well, you can bet your boots I would never let it happen again if it was at all possible. So that was the end of it, and it was like getting a mild slap on the wrist. And I thought, well, probably this means at promotion time I'll get passed over. But that didn't happen either. I got my promotions right on at the regular time. So the result on me personally was not too bad. Anyway, we finally got our orders to proceed back to the States, and we were allowed more or less to decide how we would proceed, where we would proceed. Well, we looked the charts over the area, and we decided that with only one screw, and since going through the Gulf of Alaska, Gulf of Alaska is one of the most difficult bodies of water to pass through because there are always heavy weather in there. We decided to go in at Mount Pleasant. There was an inlet there, and go down what they call the Inland Passage, the Inside Passage, down to Seattle. This would keep us inside in more or less protective area. Well, this turned out to be a very interesting trip, but also a very tricky one, because we were, with only one screw, We were not nearly as maneuverable as though we had both of them. But we managed to get on down all right. And using the Coast Pilot, which is a book that mariners used to read up on and find out the local conditions wherever you are, we found that there was a place after we had come out. We stopped at Ketchikan, by the way, which is about the lower part of Alaska, and just went ashore there for a few hours just to give everybody a little relaxation. Proceeded on down through this beautiful inland passage, which today in 1986 is one of the most popular cruise areas in the world. And Emily and I have been on a cruise in recent years coming up through there, and it was a wonderful exhilarating experience. We found by looking at the Coast Pilot that we could save some time by going through what is known as Active Pass. Well, it didn't look too tricky, and the bad thing was we would have to go through there in the middle of the night about 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, we came to that point. Fortunately, I had one of my more experienced officers as officer of the deck, Lieutenant Junior Grade Leo Carey, and we talked it over and discussed it with the helmsman and so on. So apparently we would be just going through. We had to make an S-turn in this active pass, but it didn't seem too difficult, and if we had reasonable visibility, and it was supposed to have buoys and markers, lighted buoys in there to see, we should be all right. Well, we started through, and what we hadn't anticipated was that Active Pass was very active. There were a lot of eddies and whirlpools in there. And it turned out that the S-curve in there was in a lot shorter distance than we had anticipated. It didn't look that way on the chart. But we started in, and that ship started sashaying back and forth, and that poor helmsman was about to go crazy trying to maintain a course. Well, normally I would take over, the captain would take over there, but I thought this would be a better time to let an experienced officer like Carey take it. So I just stood by. I was responsible right on, but I let Carey maintain the deck, and he brought it through in good shape. But with a lot of sashaying, as I said, back and forth, trying to maintain a course going through there. Well, after we got through there, everybody heaved a great sigh of relief that we didn't end up on the rocks again. That would have been really the end of us. So we continued on down, and as we were approaching Vancouver, we had to go through another very tricky area, and this was called Seymour Narrows. It was a very narrow passage, just a couple of hundred feet between two promontories, and according to the Coast Pilot, no ship should go through there except at absolute high tide or low tide, because even 10 minutes either side of high or low tide, you would get terrific eddying and whirlpool action. Well, we'd had enough of that at Active Pass, so we gauged our passage to arrive about a half an hour before mean high water, and we lay to waiting for that high water time to come. Well, when the time came, I said, okay, let's go. We started through there. And you know that it only took us about 10 minutes to go through that passage, but even before we were all the way through in that 10-minute period, we could feel the water boiling beneath us. And our helmsman, we had our best helmsman on, and he had a tough time holding it steady, but we made it through without difficulty. Well, then it was just a standard steaming then, from then on down into Seattle and then across to Bremerton. I had a feeling of relief getting back down to the States, because Emily was had been living with friends of hers, George and Francis Henry, since I had left the States, and she had become pregnant before we left. This was with Joanna, our first child. We didn't know it was going to be a girl at that time, of course. But we knew the time that the baby was expected was in the early part of December. We were now in early December, and I said, here's my hope that we can get down there in time so that I can be with her for the arrival of the baby. In the meantime, her mother, Clara Olson, had come on out from Florida and was staying with her, so that made it easier for her and gave me a lot of peace of mind, too, to know that Clara was with her. Well, we got into Bremerton, and my brother was there. He was stationed at Bremerton. He was an assistant supervisor of shipbuilding, and he was assigned, when they found out that there was a family connection, they assigned him to our ship. So he had a lot to do with our repair work while we were there. And of course, his wife, Irene, was there. They lived in a town nearby, so we got to see each other quite a bit. But we still had this problem of the baby. When was the baby going to arrive? Well, every day I was in touch with Emily, and the baby was late. She was due about the 6th or 7th or 8th, somewhere in there, and that time passed and still not there. Well, I couldn't just pick up and go down and wait for her, because it might be a couple of weeks yet. And I had to be there to supervise the repairs to the ship. Well, one evening about 8 o'clock, I got a call. The call was, I was paged. And it was Clara, and she said, you have a baby girl. And I said, oh, good, and I'm so relieved. And so I had to, then I got right busy and got emergency leave, and got right out to Sands Point, which is the Navy airfield nearby, and they flew me down there. It was about a 1,000-mile flight, flying over the High Sierras, kind of a rough trip, but I couldn't wait to get down there. Well, I came into the hospital, and Emily had been through a very rough time bringing Joanna into the world, but she was beginning to come out of it by then, and it was a wonderful reunion under the circumstances, and I got to see our new baby, Joanna, a beautiful little dark-haired gal. I take that back, she was blonde at that time. She became dark-haired later on in life. Anyway, we eventually got our ship repaired and brought it on down to San Francisco. And we had another short period of shakedown to test out the repairs that had been made. And we were around there, that area, for about 3 weeks. And Emily and Joanna got to come over and have dinner aboard the ship. Joanna, of course, didn't have the stake that Emily and I had in the wardroom, but she got to sleep on my big leather couch in my captain's stateroom. Well, presently, all good things like this had to come to an end, and we had to move on out to Pearl Harbor for reassignment. This was in late January, early February, and we were given a escort job to escort a merchant ship out there. We were about halfway out when the word came over from the ship that there was one of the seamen on board the merchant ship had appendicitis. What should we do? Well, they dumped it right in my lap, and this was my first experience of this kind. Well, we had the division doctor aboard, Dr. Boggs, and we were going to send him aboard, but we found that there were two ships in the convoy. We found that there was a doctor, a Navy doctor, who was a surgeon, who was aboard the other ship that we were escorting. So we decided to try to transfer that doctor to the other ship where the man had appendicitis. We made a very gingerly approach from the port quarter of this merchant ship, and we had a crew up in our bow ready to help get him off. Well, this maneuver was too tricky for the reason that there was a pretty heavy swell running. Now that meant this big merchant ship, which was many times the size of our 220-footer, 1,000-tonner, had a different motion than we did, and we tried it about three times, but we just couldn't make it. In fact, we grazed our bow on his stern, his port quarter, so we decided that it was just too dangerous. We might kill the doctor in the process of maneuvering him off onto us and then onto the other ship. Well, it turned out he gave instructions, and they packed the man in ice, and he came through without having to have an operation. We went into Pearl, and right away we got assignments running escort runs down to Eniwetok and other islands down on the Marshalls. The Marshalls had by that time had been secured, and that was a kind of a steady run for us. Well, our next major operation would occur in June of 1944, and as commanding officer, I was brought into the secret plans of the next operation, which was scheduled to be landings in the Marianas, both on Saipan and Guam. We met, had different conferences with the overall commanders, Holland Smith, General Holland Smith of the Marines, and the appropriate naval commanders, and we were given assignments of being in the screen, the anti-submarine screen, along with destroyers. We were the only non-destroyer in the screen of our particular convoy. But we started moving out from Pearl, went to Eniwetok, staged there, picked up more ships, and then headed on for Saipan. The landing was scheduled for the morning of June 15th. Well, the fast carrier forces were already out there ahead of us. For about a week ahead of time, they were out there bombarding and dive bombing Saipan and Guam. And the night before the landing, we were making our approach around the north end of Saipan, and it was like the 4th of July. They were making night bombardment from the big ships, and the booming and the flashes and all was pretty exciting, but also we were approaching with trepidation because this was our first major landing. Well, we'd had a landing while we were up in the Aleutians that was really was a false alarm. That was the landing on Kiska, and we were in the landing force of that, but on the landing of Kiska, the Japanese had very cleverly removed all their men and completed the moving about a week before the landing, and there was nobody on shore when we made the landing. Well, we did our sweeping and didn't find any mines, but one of the destroyers, the Anderson, which was in our convoy the night before the landing, hit a floating mine and blew off part of her stern, killing about 15 men. So there were some mines around, but we found none on the landing area that we were assigned to sweep. Back to Saipan. Morning, early light came, and we were ready to start doing our job, which was the sweeping job. The main landing was to take place at Sharon Canoa, which was on the west side of the island. The fast destroyer minesweepers had already made a couple of passes through there, but they were not what we would call clearing sweeps. They just make a couple of sweeps just to find out if there are any mines around there. Well, there were none, at least where they were sweeping, so we formed up with our divisions of AMs, and we started the sweeps. Well, all of the excitement and confusion that was going on, shortly after we made our sweeps in there, we had to get out of the way so that the landing force could come in with their small landing vessels, LCMs and AVPs. And so we were told to clear out of there and get out of the way of them. Well, we had a ringside seat for this landing, and it was a tough one. They landed, the Japs were ready for them, and they were just pouring everything down there. They managed to get in there and get a toehold. Well, since we had no further duties there, we were given orders, our whole division, four ships were given orders to go around the north end of the island and come down and sweep Magician Bay, which was on the directly opposite on the east side of the island. Well, it turned out Magician Bay was where the Japanese expected the main landing to occur, where you would expect then that there would be a lot of shore bombardment, in other words, firing it out at us. But we came down, formed up, and started sweeping Magician Bay, expecting some bombardment. Well, it did not come. Well, the reason was our forces had several heavy cruisers laying offshore from us, and they were pouring bombardment from sea